What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's Resistance in Residence artist is award-winning and multi-nominated Los Angeles-based actress, playwright, and author Robin Riker. And this is a very special interview for me, y'all, because Robin Riker is also my godmother. Thank you so much for joining us, Robin.
Oh, thank you. I just got chills when you said that last bit of the introduction.
I'm super stoked.
Heck with the actress and all that stuff. It was, oh, my godmother. That gave me chills.
This is my godmother, y'all, who I definitely wanted to be when I grew up. And so let's start, Robin, with a bit about you and specifically where and how you grew up and what your family was like.
Well, I'm third generation performer on both sides of my family. My grandmother was an amateur actress on my mother's side. My mother was a professional actress, director, and writer. And my father, his father was a clown in Ringling Brothers. So this fits perfectly into Hollywood. And my father then went on to do radio, which that tickled me this morning thinking we were going to be doing this. He was a juvenile actor in a lot of radio shows back in the day, and then went on to work in the theater and film and television. My parents owned their own legit theater in Aspen and for a couple of years. And then, as the theater will sometimes do to people, they decided they needed a divorce. My mom went back to university to get her master's in theater and at Boulder. And that's where I was classically trained. I was on stage since I was four, because my parents had a very practical philosophy. If you have children, use them. But dig this, I had to audition for my parents, okay? So when your mother calls you up and tells you, we went another way, you can't really call your agent and complain. So I worked with the Colorado Shakespeare Festival as a child for a couple of years. And then we moved to Atlanta, where she was executive director of Theater Atlanta there. And then we moved, of all places, to South Dakota, where she taught at a Yankton College in Yankton, South Dakota. It is now a white-collar prison. Isn't that fabulous?
Wow.
Yeah. And I went there to visit some years ago. And the fence is like a decorative fence in a garden. You can step over it. So I guess they don't think their prisoners are too dangerous. And there in Yankton, South Dakota, oddly enough, they had a very vibrant theater program. So I participated in that. And then we moved to Syracuse, where mom got her doctorate, and I worked in theater there. And then at 17, I busted out, went to Mexico with a couple of friends, and then moved to Northern California, just kept working in theater there, and then made the move to LA some years ago.
And have been working in the industry ever since.
Yeah.
Which is a massive accomplishment. And I want to talk about that, because I think that you, like, people that get into the business, they think they want to be famous, but I think that they actually want to work consistently, be recognized for their really good work, and still maybe be able to go to the grocery store on the rest, perhaps.
I would to buy a cookie occasionally.
Occasionally, yeah. Not to have to send, your bodyguard or whatever. But before we get to your amazing career, moved around a lot and moved around a lot inside of the world of theater. How do you think that shaped your worldview?
Well, I think it just expanded it enormously, of course, because the more people we meet, the different people we meet, the different cultures we're exposed to, the better we are, the more rounded we are as humanity. I mean, even with her going to various universities and teaching in a college town, you meet people from everywhere. I mean, I grew up with kids from Pakistan, from Africa, from China, from Japan, all different sorts of people. And I think it lets one see that we are one. You know, I mean, there's, it's very expansive. It was great. I loved it. I wouldn't have changed it at all, the moving.
So you go to LA, and the first thing that I remember, you may get irked with me for bringing this up, but it is. The first thing I remember seeing you in was at a drive-in movie theater on the big screen. And it was a horror film called Alligator.
Yeah. I'm not irked.
Good. Good.
Well, chiefly not irked because it was a film written by John Sayles, who went on to great acclaim. It was directed by a director named Lewis Teague, and my co-star was the very fabulous late Robert Forster. And it was great fun, a very glamorous debut. We shot in the storm drains of Los Angeles. It was so romantic. I loved it.
And then the next thing I remember was like before we, yeah, Brothers, cable television show. Yeah.
We were one of the first cable series ever. It was on Showtime. And we were, this was so thrilling. We were groundbreakers because it was the first television series that had openly gay characters in it. Every Tuesday night, we filmed at Paramount Studios, and every gay bar in LA had the TV tuned to the show when it aired, which was on, I think, Wednesday nights. But every Tuesday night, the theater was filled with fans who wanted to come and watch us tape. We taped live, and we changed lives. It was so remarkable, Kat, because we would get letters from families that said, my father was furious when my brother came out. And then we sat down and started watching this show that had all different kinds of people in it. There was an Archie Bunker kind of character and a sports guy who ran a bar and all of that. So it was the gay, there were just two people who were gay in it, but it brought families together. And now my father and my brother are talking to each other, says the letter. And it gave people courage to come out. And it was so meaningful. I was so proud to be a part of that.
And doesn't it speak to the ways in which art can change the world, change minds, yes, bring us together, heal?
Yes. Yes. Oh, and we need that now more than ever, don't we?
I would agree. Well, those are my two early memories as a kid watching my godmother on the screen. Talk about the other highlights for you of your career. I will say to you all that my godmother, Robin Riker, has nonstop worked in Hollywood and done it on her own terms, which I'll talk about.
Thank you, baby girl. I appreciate that.
No, it's super important. Super important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because, you know, one of the things I say in my book is that you should never want anything so much that you will compromise your integrity to get it. And I'm so glad that I was able to stick to that. And the one of the other bits of advice I give is generally just no matter what you do, whether you paint houses or clean houses or build buildings, whatever you do, if something trust your gut. If something feels right, it probably is. And if something feels wrong, you're probably right. So it was just the whole experience was wonderful. I arrived with, you know, $45 and a free place to stay. And within a couple of months, luckily, I had secured an agent. And my first television series was, I'm sort of outing myself here, but I was a thing called Joe Forrester. I doubt there's a person listening who's ever even heard of it, but it was with a very famous actor at the time. And I played Girl Robber. It was quite thrilling. I was working as a waitress, cocktail waitress. And, you know, back in the day, we didn't have cell phones. And so you had an answering service. And I checked my answering service and I got a few calls from this man named Roe Wallerstein. And I thought that maybe he was one of the fellows that I had given my phone number to because you know, who wanted to take me out or something, but I just didn't want to say no. So I gave him my phone number. Anyway, so I finally called him back and he said, "Hey, Robin, this is Ro Wallerstein. I'm over here at Warner Brothers. If you can, I got an audition for you. If you don't get over here within the next 25 minutes, the train has left the station." So I went to my boss and I said, "I have this audition. It's just over the hill. I can be back before the happy hour starts." And he looked at me and said, "If you leave here, you don't got a job when you get back." And I untied my apron and I handed it to him. I said, "Well, I didn't come here to serve no cocktails." So I jumped in my car, went over the hill, and I got the job. And it was fun. And now I have sort of a Law and Disorder story to follow that up with, if it's cool.
Yes, please.
Just a month before weed was legalized, in essence, or not criminalized anymore for as a felony, I was on my way to work, and I ran out of gas in an intersection in West Hollywood, and somebody lit me up, a cop car lit me up from behind, and I naively got out of the car thinking, who says the cops are never around when you need them? And I get out of the car, get back in the car, they say, he grabbed stuff out of my bag, and in my bag was a little dangling baggie of some weed, but it was totally illegal. He just dove in and took it. So then they cuffed me and they put me in the back of the squad car. As they were searching my car, they found the script of my first show. And they said, "Oh, so you're an actress, are you?" "Yeah, well, what was you? I see the script back here. What did you play?" And I swallowed and laughed and said, "Girl robber." So, so that was fun. And so as now, I have definite distrust of the police because I know they serve a purpose, I guess, but it's just, you know, it was totally illegal what he did, and the cop lied on the stand. But the weird thing was, back then, they sent you to, you know, like if you're drunk driving or something, you go to AA meetings or something like that. I can't remember. Well, they sent you to this drug school where you make all the best contacts. It just doesn't, it does not make any sense.
I love that story. One of the other things that I remember you saying to me, I don't know why this stuck in my head, but it did. And this is, again, along the lines of you, you know, making it in Hollywood on your own terms, was about, I don't know if it was a particular shoot or if it was just your overall theory, and you can clarify for the listeners, but the concept of running away, women running away when their lives are in danger and still wearing high heels.
Oh my God. I know. It makes no, and they don't take them off.
Right.
You know, now more and more I am seeing that a woman will reach down and take off her high heels. But it's this whole frickin' damsel in distress thing that I know I don't usually talk like this, but the patriarchy is trying to keep, you know, intact. But we don't have to be in distress anymore. We have we do have to worry, but we do have power now, more power. I hope this upcoming election restores the power.
Yes, well, we hope. Hollywood, Robin, was, and this is like pre-Me Too movement, pre all these conversations we're having now, like when you got there, notoriously sexist, notoriously misogynistic, fighting with director about whether or not you could take off your heels to run away during a scene where you were, you know, fleeing for your life.
Right.
In what ways did you experience it and how did you navigate it?
Well, I recognized it. I don't know why. I think I attribute a lot of my instinct just to my mother in a way, you know. I mean, and I felt very empowered by her and the work that she did and her confidence in herself. And I just, it was always my instinct to stand up for myself and to say no. I mean, I could recognize a creep, you know, from 20 paces, even before they spoke. And I know this may not be the the most politically correct phrase, but you can be a lady and rule the world, you know? And I think that knowing who you are, standing up for what you want, you don't have to get down and dirty. A person who is operating from their integrity, who trusts their gut. That's what I think. Sorry, it's too late to make a long story short, but I think going back to that saying, if something feels right, it probably is. And if something feels wrong, you're probably right. So the way I negotiated it was I listened to my instincts. I followed my gut. If it felt wrong, I didn't play.
Yeah, and I y'all don't want to see Robin when she's not playing. she does it with integrity. You might not even know she's done playing until it's too late. Robin Riker, you are also a writer. The book that you were referencing earlier is called A Survivor's Guide to Hollywood, How to Play the Game Without Losing Your Soul. When did you start writing and what new worlds did it open up for you?
Oh, again, I have chills with that one. Literally, Kat, all over me. I started writing. The first thing I ever wrote that I remember was a song, and I was five. So I wrote a song, and then I loved language from I think in utero, I loved language. My mother read to me, I think, when I was in utero, and then read when I was a kid, and I just loved it. And I remember all my life, I mean, from the time I was very little, I wanted to spell. So I would say, Mom, does Q or Z spell anything? And she would say, no, not, you're wrong there. And so my first word, again, appropriate for Hollywood, the first word I spelled successfully was zoo. I was thrilled. So I wrote, like I said, my first song then, and then I liked to just write little stories. And whenever we got creative writing opportunities in school, until I was in seventh grade, I would get A for content over D for grammar. So I had to kick up my punctuation game. But then the language is the most wonderful thing, to be able to know words and speak to people and reach them has always been one of my most favorite things in the world. And so reading, and writing just seemed to go together. I have written a couple of screenplays, and which I really like, and I'm starting to shop around a bit. And this book, and I've started a series of short stories and a little short film that I'm working on right now. And so it's just, you know, I've always loved writing, and I think many writers might say this, you yourself might say this. Once I'm sitting down and writing, I'm in heaven. And when the agent calls and I have an audition, I'm like, really? I'm busy. I mean, what is happening? So, but for me, once I'm writing, I'm in bliss. But getting my ass in the chair is the hardest part of it.
Yes.
You know?
I do know. Well, you did get your ass in a chair and write a piece that I think my listeners will enjoy. So I'd like you to share it with us, if you will.
Oh, thank you very much. It is inspired by this do-nothing political situation that we have in Congress right now. And it is entitled, How? How do you get so many cowards in one place? How do they maintain such silence? How do they turn their backs on their oaths and accept so much hatred and violence? What do they see in this traitorous swindler that makes them dishonor themselves? Do they truly not see that inside this creature it's only love for himself that dwells? How do they justify their lack of integrity and continue to believe it's okay? What do they say to their children and spouses at the end of a wasted day? Instead of protecting the people they serve or the allies we need to survive, they want to protect themselves and their jobs. No need to keep democracy alive. Not a one will stand up, not a backbone among them. They whimper and bow to their master and abandon their morals, assuming they had some, and pretend it won't lead to disaster. What do they hope to derive from obeisance? Do they think we, the people, don't notice their lickspittle fawning and fear and their dangerous, stupid complacence? The MAGAs outside of Capitol Hill are more than dangerous enough, but to be paying the wages of maggots inside is too much. It's simply too much. They must be called out by district and name and be held to account for their sins. If we too are afraid to name them and shame them, then it is the fools and the cowards who win.
Hey, thank you, Robin Riker.
Thank you, my darling.
Oh, I'm not done with you yet. I have a couple more minutes. Okay. I have a couple more minutes with you.
Goody.
So I think that was a good example. But I say a lot that it is the role of artists to help us see the world we are trying to build, to make it more tangible for us. Mm-hmm. How would you say you create new worlds in your work?
Well, I hope I do. I mean, I write and I get it out there as much as possible. I could probably do a better job of that. But I feel as though it only takes one person to be sparked by something to help spread it to others. And I've done several, there are a bunch of things. I have a company I call WTF Productions. You can imagine what that stands for. And I've done, you know, videos about spoofing videos about the orange monster and things political and those can all be found. And I think it sometimes just speaking out gives someone else permission to speak out. You know, that oh, it's okay. And one by one by one, it would be wonderful if we could just move millions immediately, but one by one, you know? And so I'm hoping that the things that I say and just putting in words the things that others are thinking and feeling is helpful. It's certainly helpful to me anyway.
And you mentioned that you're working on some writing things. Any other gigs that we should know about or look for you in coming down the pike?
Let's see. We just had a Christmas movie. And then, of course, my favorite crazy movie can be seen on, I think you can see it on YouTube now and on Lifetime. And it's called, I'm so proud of this, my Shakespearean director would be thrilled. It's called Psycho Granny.
I've seen that one.
It's so fun because as an actor, you get to do everything, you know? And so that's a fun one to watch. But I'm doing a theater gig in March. We're for Women's Month, we're doing a tribute to Ruth Bader Ginsburg up at a small theater in Carpentry. It's a live thing, so if you're not in the area, you wouldn't see it. But I'm happy to be doing it. They're replicating several of her cases, and so actors will be playing the justices. I'm so delighted because Ruth Bader Ginsburg was obviously on the court with Sandra Day O'Connor, and I feel like I have two little connections to this. My aunt, my mother's sister, was in the same sorority and attended Stanford at the same time that Sandra Day O'Connor was there. And then my grandfather, the record has likely been broken, but in the 1950s, my grandfather was the youngest attorney to ever argue a case before the Supreme Court and win. And he did it, and this goes right back to my writing roots, I think. He did it way before, you know, tricks and things were introduced into the courtroom. He was a corporate lawyer, and there was a sentence in dispute of a contract that he had. And so he wrote the sentence out on a chalkboard, wheeled the chalkboard into the Supreme Court, and won his case by diagramming a sentence.
Wow.
Yeah. You would have thought I would have had more genetic material for my punctuation back in seventh grade, but no.
And Robert Riker, for those who have fallen in love with you during this interview and want to know more about you and your work, where should they go?
Well, my X handle is at Robin_Riker. And then Real Robin Riker is Instagram. And then my website is www.robinriker.com.
And she did, you all mentioned that IMDb list. It is a long and impressive list. You've had such an amazing career, Robin. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Kat. It's wonderful. And speaking of amazing careers, you ain't doing so bad yourself.
Thanks, Godmom.
I love you, baby.
I love you, too. You all have been listening to Law & Disorder. This week's Resistance in Residence artist is award-winning, multi-nominated, Los Angeles-based actress, playwright, author, and my godmother, Robin Riker. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law & Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.